because I'm taking Quakerism just as a sample of one religion which expresses many of the features of other religions. Last time we talked about science, and I feel most at home in science and philosophy, I suppose, more than I do in these other subjects, because I got my doctor's degree in both physics and philosophy. So theoretically I should be quite at home in these subjects, but actually during the course of years, many years, ideas fade and lose their validity and vividness. Philosophy, I feel, is certainly not what it used to be in my day when I studied philosophy at Harvard. I don't think I could name one prominent philosopher today. I could name a number of theologians, but philosophers have kind of fallen into the background. And I think one reason is that they have given up trying to answer ultimate questions like what is truth or the meaning of life and things of that sort. The modern philosophers are mostly dealing with analysis and clarification. The language philosophers, the existentialists, and the logical positivists, none of them answer ultimate questions regarding the meaning of truth, religion, and life. They're confined very largely to the present in their speculations, and not to the infinite future or the infinite past, as the philosophers in my youth, comparative youth, used to do. I was at Harvard during the greatest day of American philosophy, I think. The most prominent philosopher there was, of course, William James and Josiah Royce. And I think they were the two leading philosophers of that time. George Santayana was another one. I had a course under him, and I still have some essays that I wrote that are filled with comments that he made on blank pages. And he took the time to write even a whole page of comments in criticizing essays that I attempted to write. And George Herbert Palmer was probably the leading ethical philosopher at the time, and the man who most influenced Rufus Jones at Haverford. Rufus Jones is the most famous Quaker philosopher and author, but he only attempted one book that was strictly philosophical, The Social Law in the Spiritual World. That was written when I was at Haverford, and it comes very largely from the philosophy of Josiah Royce and George Herbert Palmer. After that book, I think Rufus nearly always confined himself to devotional books rather than to attempts at philosophy, for he was much more of a preacher, let us say, than he was a philosopher. Well, philosophy is a subject today which doesn't have too good a reputation on account of its giving up of ultimate problems, and because of it, the existentialists and others of that type teach a philosophy of despair that you can't get over in this finite and restricted existence with its ultimate boundaries which we can't cross. It's been said that a philosopher's is a blind man looking in a dark room for a black cat that isn't there. Or philosophy gives bad reasons for things we believe on instinct. I think there's something to that statement. Many things that we do believe on instinct are substantiated by philosophers with reasons that may or not be completely valid. Or it's been said, philosophy bakes no bread. Well, I think a baker wouldn't bake bread unless he was a philosopher, because the fact that he bakes bread means that he thinks life is worth living. And if life is worth living, that is a very substantial and important philosophy. And I think everyone has a philosophy. I've had doctors come to me who were only dealing with patients who were old and about to die. That was true pretty much of the population of Southern California. I guess it still is. And they were wondering whether it was really worthwhile keeping these people alive when life really meant so little to them. Well, they were philosophers, and they didn't know what philosophy to adopt. Or the people at the agricultural college were very much bewildered. They were teaching farmers how to grow two blades of grass where only one grew before. And here was the government telling them at the same time to limit their production, and is actually paying them not to raise pigs and not to raise more than so much wheat or corn. And so they were caught between two very different philosophies. One was restricting their production, and one was endeavoring to increase it. So they didn't know what to think. I think philosophy does enter into all our lives, and everybody has a philosophy, whether they know it or not. Science and religion have been, I think, somewhat at odds with each other at various times in human history, not because of what they are in themselves, but because a certain philosophy of science is at odds with a certain philosophy of religion. And I think the trouble has been there that science has endeavored to trespass on the area of religion, and religion has tried to trespass on the area of science. And what I tried to say last time was that science had certain very definite limitations which did not allow it to interfere with religion, and religion had certain very definite limitations which did not permit it to interfere with science. For instance, in science, there is no such word as ought. Everything in science, at least in mechanistic science of Newton and his successors, everything is determined. Every scientific law works absolutely and without any exceptions. We can't say of a machine that it ought to do this or ought not. A machine will do just what it's constructed to do. If it breaks down, that's because something's wrong with it. At least we say it's wrong, from the machine's point of view. Like, I suppose it's all right. At any rate, if the world is a machine, if we do believe in mechanistic science, then everything is predetermined by scientific laws. And there is no such thing as freedom. So there is no such thing as ought. It's not a scientific word. I think it's interesting to note that Calvinistic predestination and mechanistic science began about the same time in the 16th and 17th centuries, and probably influenced each other, because in mechanistic science you have complete predetermination by scientific laws to which there are no exceptions, and in Calvinistic religion you have complete predestination. Certain persons are elected to be saved, certain ones are elected to be damned, and there's nothing you can do about it yourself. Nothing that you do, good or bad, will influence God's arbitrary selection of certain persons to be elected to go to heaven and certain persons to be damned to go to hell. And that was the religion of Protestantism at the time Quakerism arose. Even the Anglicans were Calvinistic. I don't think they are anymore. The only groups that weren't Calvinistic were the Quakers, who believed in freedom of the will, and the Arminian Baptists, what are sometimes called the soft-shell Baptists. The hard-shell Baptists were the predestinarian Baptists, who were Calvinistic, and the soft-shell Baptists were the Arminian Baptists, who believed in freedom. And a great many of the Arminian Baptists became Quakers. In fact, Fox would come to a congregation of what he called shattered Baptists, and he would succeed, without much effort, in converting them all to Quakerism, because they were nearly there already. They had women preachers, and they were not at all formalized in their service, and so they were quite willing to give up the rite of baptism and become Quakers without much, because they didn't believe a person should be baptized until he was converted anyhow. So what was the point of baptism? Well, that's one point where there is a very distinct difference. Now, science, as I say, deals with things that can be measured. Physics is the science par excellence. It's the science of sciences, and all the sciences try to imitate physics to the best, to as much as they can. And they are scientific insofar as they're able to imitate physics. Even psychology has its graphs of intelligence quotients and things of that sort, which are very much like the graphs that are used in physics and chemistry. Now, religion has made the mistake of going into the field of science, and the result is that religion has been discredited because its scientific theories have been discredited. I suppose the first hurdle that religion had to get over, and I'll speak just about the Christian religion, the early Christians expected the world to come to an end very shortly. And Paul, if you read his letters to the Thessalonians, thought that it would come to an end, and the kingdom would come, Christ would come in all his glory, the second coming would occur during the lifetime of some of his converts. He was expecting it any moment, and it never occurred. And so Christianity was forced to give up the idea of a political kingdom, and instead of that, substitute a spiritual kingdom where the members of the kingdom were perhaps known only to God and were bound together by spiritual ties. Of course, the Catholic Church, for more than 1,000 years, thought it was potentially the kingdom of God. It's like the Aristotle's idea of the oak being potential in the acorn. So the kingdom of God was potentially in the church. It was the celestial city in potentia, in possibility. Catholic Church, of course, knew that it wasn't the kingdom of heaven, but it did select certain persons, like monks and priests and nuns, to act as if they were already in the kingdom and were obeying the laws of the kingdom, even though the layman was not required. The layman could fight in war, but the priest could not, because the priest was in the kingdom and the layman wasn't.